lashed darker than I had ever seen before. They can say horrible things, hurt you, but you never fight back. And I know, Ruby, I know that's just how you are, but sometimes I wonder if you even care. Why can't you stand up for yourself just once? Her voice was barely above a whisper, but the ragged quality to it made me think she was either going to scream or burst out into hysterical tears. I glanced down to where her hands were tugging at the edges of her shorts, moving so fast and frantic that I almost didn't see the angry red marks that circled her wrists. Sam. Samantha.
I
want. She swallowed hard. Her tears caught in her eyelashes, but didn't fall.
I want to be alone now. Just for a while.
I shouldn't have reached for her. Not with fever and exhaustion pressing down on me. Not while I was trembling with a bone-deep hate for myself. But I thought, then, that if I could tell her the truth, if I could explain, she wouldn't look at me that way again. She would know that the last thing, the absolute last thing I ever wanted was for her to be hurt because of me. She was the only thing I had here. But the second my fingers touched her shoulder, the world dropped out from under me. I felt a fire start at the ends of my hair and burn its way through my skull. The fever I thought I had kicked suddenly painted the world a fuzzy shade of gray. I was seeing Sam's blank face, and she was gone, replaced by white-hot memories that didn't belong to me. A whiteboard at school filled with math problems, a golden retriever digging in a garden, a world rising and falling from the perspective of a swing, the roots of the vegetables in the garden being pulled free, the brick wall at the back of the mess hall against my face as another fist swung down toward me, a quick assault from every side, like a series of camera flashes. And when I finally came back to myself, we were still staring at each other. For a second, I thought I saw my horrified face reflected in her dark, glassy eyes. Sam wasn't looking at me. She didn't seem to be looking at anything beyond the dust floating lazy and free through the air to my right. I knew that blank look. I'd seen my mother wear it years before.
"Are you new here?" she demanded, suddenly defensive and startled.
Her eyes flicked down from my face to my bony knees, then back up again. She sucked in a deep breath, as if coming up for air after a long time beneath dark waters.
"Do you have a name, at least?"
"Ruby," I whispered. It was the last word I spoke for nearly a year.
4. I woke to cold water and a woman's soft voice. "You're all right," she was saying. "You'll be fine." I'm not sure who she thought she was fooling with her sweet little BS, but it wasn't me. I let her bring the wet towel up to my face again, savoring her warmth as she leaned in closer. She smelled of rosemary and past things. For a second, just one, her hand came to rest against mine, and it was almost more than I could take. I wasn't at home, and this woman wasn't my mother. I started gasping, desperate to keep everything inside me. I couldn't cry, not in front of her, or any of the other adults. I wouldn't give them the pleasure.
"Are you still in pain?"
The only reason I opened my eyes was because she pulled them open herself, one at a time, shining an intense light in each. I tried to throw my hands up to shield them, but they had strapped me down in Velcro cuffs. Fighting against the restraints was pointless. The woman clucked her tongue and stepped back, taking her flowery fragrance with her. The smell of antiseptic and peroxide flooded the air, and I knew exactly where I was. The sounds of Thurman's infirmary faded in and out in uneven waves. Some kid crying out in pain, boots clipping against the white tile floors, the creak of wheelchair wheels. I felt like I was standing above a tunnel with my ear to the ground, listening to the hum of cars passing beneath me.
"Ruby?"
The woman was wearing blue scrubs and a white coat. With her pale skin and white blonde hair, she all but disappeared into the thin curtain that had been pulled around my bed. She caught me staring and smiled. So wide and so pretty. The woman was the youngest doctor I'd ever seen in Thurmond, though, admittedly, I could count my trips to the infirmary on one hand. I went once for the stomach flu and dehydration after what Sam called my gut-puking spectacular, and once for a sprained wrist. Both times, I felt far worse after being groped by a pair of wrinkled hands than I had before I'd come in. Nothing cures a cold faster than the thought of an old perv wearing a cologne of alcohol and lemon hand soap. This woman, she was unreal. Everything about her. "My name is Dr. Begbie. I'm a volunteer with the Leda Corporation." I nodded, glancing at the gold swan insignia on her coat pocket. She leaned in closer. "We're a big medical company that does research and sends doctors in to help care for you guys at the camps. If it makes you feel more comfortable, you're more than welcome to call me Kate and leave off the doctor business." Sure I was. I stared at the hand she extended toward me. Silence hung between us, punctuated by the pounding in my head. After an awkward moment, Dr. Begbie stuffed her hand back into the pocket of her lab coat, but not before letting it stray over the restraint securing my left hand to the bed's guardrail. "Do you know why you're here, Ruby? Do you remember what happened?" Before or after the tower tried to fry my brain. But I couldn't say it out loud. When it came to the adults, it was better not to talk. They had a way of hearing one thing and processing it as something else. No reason to give them an excuse to hurt you. It had been 8 months since I'd last used my voice. I wasn't sure I even remembered how. The doctor somehow guessed the question I was barely holding back at the tip of my tongue. "They turned on the calm control after a fight broke out in the mess hall. It seems that things got a bit out of hand." That was an understatement. The white noise, calm control, the higher powers called it, was used to settle us down, so to speak, while it did absolutely nothing to them. It was like a dog whistle, the pitch tuned perfectly so only our freak brains could pick it up and process it. They turned it on for a whole host of reasons, sometimes for things as small as a kid accidentally using their ability, or to stamp out unruliness in one of the cabins. But in both of those instances, they would have piped the noise directly into whatever building the kids were in. If they used it across the camp, blasting it over the speakers for us all to hear, then things must have gotten really out of hand. They must have been worried that there was a spark that would have set the rest of us ablaze. There was no hint of hesitation on Dr. Begbie's face as she unstrapped my wrists and ankles. The towel she had been using to clean my face hung limp on the guardrail, dripping water. Bright red splotches soaked through its white fabric. I reached up and touched my mouth, my cheeks, my nose. When I pulled my fingers away, I was only half surprised to see that they were coated with dark blood. It was crusted between my nostrils and lips, as if someone had clocked me right in the honker. Trying to sit up was the worst idea that crossed my mind. My chest screamed in pain, and I was flat on my back again before I even registered falling. Dr. Begbie was beside me in an instant, cranking the metal bed into an upright position. "You have some bruised ribs," she said. I tried to take a deep breath, but my chest was too tight to inhale anything more than a choked gasp. She must not have noticed, because she was looking at me with those kind eyes again, saying, "May I ask a few questions?" The fact that she asked my permission was amazing in and of itself. I studied her, searching for the hatred buried beneath the layer of pleasantness on her face, the fear hovering in her soft eyes, the disgust caught in the corner of her smile. Nothing. Not even annoyance. Some poor kid started to throw up in the stall to my right. I could see his dark outline like a shadow against the curtain. There was no one sitting with him, no one holding his hand, just him and his bowl of puke. And here I was, my heart skipping beats out of fear that the fairy tale princess sitting next to me was going to have to put me down like a rabid dog. She didn't know what I was. She couldn't have known. "You're being paranoid," I told myself. "Get a grip." Dr. Begbie pulled a pen out of her messy bun. "Ruby, when they turned on the calm control, do you remember falling forward and hitting your face?"
"No," I said.
I was already on the ground. I didn't know how much to tell her. The smile on her face stretched, and there was something smug about it.
Do you usually experience this much pain and bleeding from the calm control?
Suddenly, the pain in my chest had nothing to do with my ribs.
I'll take that as a no.
I couldn't see what she was writing, only that her hand and pen were flying across the paper, scribbling as though her life depended on it. I always took the white noise harder than the other girls in my cabin. But blood? Never. Dr. Begbie was humming lightly under her breath as she wrote, some song that I thought might have been by the Rolling Stones. She's with the camp controllers, I reminded myself. She is one of them. But in another world, she might not have been. Even though she was wearing the scrubs and white coat, Dr. Begbie didn't look much older than I was. She had a young face, and it was probably a curse to her in the outside world. I had always thought that people born before Generation Freak were the lucky ones. They lived without fear of what would happen when they stepped over the border between childhood and adolescence. As far as I knew, if you were older than 13 when they started rounding kids up, you were home free. You got to pass Freak Camp on the board game of life and head straight on to Normalville. But looking at Dr. Begbie now, seeing the deep lines carved in her face that no one in their 20s should have had, I wasn't so sure they had gotten off scot-free. They'd gotten a better deal than what we ended up with, though. Abilities. Powers that defied explanation. Mental talents so freakish, doctors and scientists reclassified our entire generation as Psi. We were no longer human. Our brains broke that mold.
I see from your chart that you were classified as abnormal intelligence in sorting, Dr. Begbie said after a while. The scientist that sorted you, did he run you through all of the tests?
Something very cold coiled in my stomach. I might not have understood a great many things about the world. I might have only had a fourth grader's education, but I could tell when someone was trying to fish around for information. The PSFs had switched over to outright scare tactics years ago, but there was a time when all of their questioning had been done in soft voices. Fake sympathy reeked like bad breath.
Does she know?
Maybe she ran a few tests while I was unconscious and scanned my brain or tested my blood or something. My fingers curled one by one until both hands were tight fists. I tried to work the line of thought through, but I kept getting caught on the possibility. Fear made things hazy and light. Her question hung in the air, suspended somewhere between truth and lie. The clip of boots against the pristine tile forced my eyes up, away from the doctor's face. Each step was a warning, and I knew they were coming before Dr. Begbie turned her head. She moved to push herself away from the bed, but I didn't let her. I don't know what possessed me, but I grabbed her wrist. The list of punishments for touching an authority figure running through my head like a skipping CD, each scratch sharper than the next. We weren't supposed to touch anyone, not even each other.
It was different this time,
I whispered, the words aching in my throat. My voice sounded different to my ears, weak. Dr. Begbie only had enough time to nod, the slightest movement, almost imperceptible, before a hand ripped back the curtain. I had seen this Psi Special Forces officer before. Sam called him the Grinch, because he looked like he had stepped straight out of the movie, save for no green skin. The Grinch cast one look at me, his top lip peeling back in annoyance, before waving the doctor forward. She blew out a sigh and set her clipboard down on my lap.
Thank you, Ruby, she said. If your pain gets any worse, call for help, okay?
Was she on drugs? Who was going to help? The kid throwing up his stomach lining next door? I nodded anyway, watching her turn to go. The last glimpse I had of her was her hand dragging the curtain back around. It was nice of her to give me privacy, but a little naive given the black cameras hanging down between the beds. The bulbs were installed all over Thurmond, lidless eyes always watching, never blinking. There were two cameras in our cabin alone, one on each end of the room, as well as one outside the door. It seemed like overkill, but when I was first brought to camp, there were so few of us that they really could watch us all day, every day, until their brains were ready to burst from boredom. You had to squint to see it, but a tiny red light inside the black eye was the only clue that the camera had zeroed in on you. Over the years, as more and more kids were brought into Thurmond on the old school buses, Sam and I began to notice that the cameras in our cabin no longer had the blinking red lights. Not every day. Same went for the cameras in the laundry, the washrooms, and the mess hall. I guess with 3,000 kids spread out over a square mile, it was impossible to watch everyone all the time. Still, they watched enough to put the fear of God in us. You had a better-than-average chance of being busted if you practiced your abilities, even under the cover of darkness. Those blinking lights were the exact same shade as the blood-red band the PSFs wore around the upper part of their right arm. The symbol for the Greek letter Psi was stitched on the crimson fabric, indicating their unfortunate role as caretakers of the country's freak children. The camera above my bed had no red light. The relief that came over me at the realization actually made the air taste sweet. For just a moment, I was alone and unobserved. At Thurmond, that was an almost unheard-of luxury. Dr. Begbie, Kate, hadn't completely closed the curtain. When another doctor hurried past, the thin white fabric pulled back farther, allowing a familiar flash of blue to catch my eye. The portrait of a young boy, no more than 12 years old, stared back at me. His hair was the same shade as mine, deep brown, nearly black. But where my eyes were pale green, his were dark enough to burn from a distance. He was smiling, as always, his hands clasped in his lap, his dark school uniform without a wrinkle. Clancy Gray, Thurmond's first inmate. There were at least two framed pictures of him in the mess hall, one in the kitchen, several nailed outside of the green outhouses. It was easier to remember his face than it was to remember my mom's. I forced myself to look away from his proud, unwavering grin. He may have gotten out, but the rest of us were still here. As I tried to readjust my body, I knocked Dr. Begbie's clipboard off my lap and into the crook of my left arm. I knew there was a chance that they were watching, but I didn't care. Not then, when I had answers inches away from my fingertips. Why had she left it there, right below my nose, if she hadn't wanted me to see it? Why hadn't she taken it with her, like all of the other doctors would have done? What was different about the white noise? What did they figure out? The fluorescent lights above me were exposed, glowing in the shape of long, angry bones. They gave off a hum, sounding more and more like a cloud of flies swirling around my ears. It only got worse as I flipped the clipboard over. It wasn't my medical history. It wasn't my current injuries or lack thereof. It wasn't my answers to Dr. Begbie's questions. It was a note. And it read, "New CC was testing for undetected Ys, Os, Rs. Your bad reaction means that they know you aren't G. Unless you do exactly as I say, they will kill you tomorrow." My hands were shaking. I had to set the clipboard down in my lap to read the rest. "I can get you out. Take the two pills under this note before bed, but don't let the PSF see you. If you don't, we'll keep your secret, but I can't protect you while you're in here. Destroy this." It was signed, "A friend, if you'd like." I read the note one more time before I ripped it out from under the metal clip and shoved it in my mouth. It tasted like the bread they served us for lunch. The pills were in a tiny, clear bag clipped on top of my real medical chart. Scrawled in Dr. Begbie's dismal handwriting was the note. "Subject, 3285, hit her head against the ground and lost consciousness. Nose was fractured when subject 3286 elbowed her. Possible concussion." My eyes were itching to look up, to peer into the black eye of the camera, but I didn't let myself. I took the pills and shoved them into the standard-issue sports bra the camp controllers had bestowed on us when they realized 1,500 teenage girls weren't going to stay 12 and flat forever. I didn't know what I was doing. I really didn't. My heart was racing so fast that for a moment I couldn't get any air. Why had Dr. Begbie done this to me? She knew I wasn't green, but she had covered it up, lied on the report. Was this just a trick? To see if I would incriminate myself? I pressed my face into my hands. The packet of pills burned against my skin. They will kill you tomorrow. Why did they even bother to wait? Why not take me out to the buses and shoot me now? Isn't that what they did with the others? The yellows, oranges, and reds? They killed them because they were too dangerous. I am too dangerous. I didn't know how to use my abilities. I wasn't like the other oranges who could spout off commands or slip nasty little thoughts into other people's minds. I had all of the power and none of the control. All of the pain and none of the benefits. From what I'd been able to figure out, I had to touch someone for my abilities to take hold, and even then, it was more like I was glimpsing their thoughts rather than screwing with them. I'd never tried to push a thought into someone else's head, and it wasn't like I'd had the opportunity or desire to try. Every slip of the mind, intentional or not, left my head a jumble of thoughts and images, words and pain. It took hours to feel like myself again. Imagine someone reaching straight into your chest, past the bones and blood and guts, and taking a nice, firm hold on your spinal cord. And now imagine that they start shaking you so fast the world starts bulging and buckling under you. Imagine not being able to figure out later if the thought in your head is really yours or an unintentional keepsake from someone else's mind. Imagine the guilt of knowing you saw someone's deepest, darkest fear or secret. Imagine having to face them the next morning and pretend you didn't see how their father used to hit them, the bright pink dress they wore to their fifth birthday party, their fantasies about this boy or that girl, and the neighborhood animals they used to kill for fun. And then imagine the soul-crushing migraine that always follows, lasting anywhere between a few hours and a few days. That was what it was like. That was why I tried to avoid my mind so much as brushing up against someone else's at all costs. I knew the consequences. All of them. And now I knew for certain what would happen if they found me out. I flipped the clipboard over on my lap, and just in time. The same PSF soldier was back at my curtain again, ripping it aside. "You'll be returning to your cabin now," he said. "Come with me." "My cabin?" I searched his face for any sign of a lie, but saw nothing except the usual annoyance. A nod was the only thing I could muster. My entire body was one earthquake of dread, and the moment my feet touched the ground, the back of my head uncorked. Everything spilled out, every thought, fear, and image. I collapsed against the guardrail, holding on tight to consciousness. The black spots were still gliding in front of my eyes when the PSF barked out, "Hurry it up! Don't think you get to stay another night here just by putting on an act." Despite the harsh words, I saw the slightest flicker of fear in his face. That moment, the shift from fear to fury could have summed up the feelings of every soldier at Thurmond. We'd heard rumors that service in the military was no longer voluntary, that everyone between the ages of 22 and 40 had to serve, most of them in the Army's new Psi branch. I gritted my teeth. The whole wide world spun under me, trying to pull me back down to its dark center. The PSF's words returned to me. "Another night?" I thought. "How long have I been here?" Still woozy, I followed the soldier into the hallway. The infirmary was only two stories, small ones. The ceiling crept down so low that even I felt like I was in danger of scraping the top of my head on the door frames. The treatment beds were on the first floor, but the second was reserved for kids needing to go into what we called time out. Sometimes they had something the rest of us could catch, but mostly it was for kids that went completely off their rocker, broken brains broken further by Thurmond. I tried to stay focused on the movement of the PSF's shoulder blades beneath his black uniform, but it was difficult when most of the curtains had been left open for anyone to peer inside. Most I could ignore or cast only a brief glance their way, but the second-to-last stall before the exit doors? My feet slowed of their own accord, giving my lungs time to breathe in the scent of rosemary, I could hear Dr. Begbie's gentle voice as she spoke to another kid in green. I recognized him. His cabin was directly across from mine. Matthew, maybe Max. All I knew was that there was blood on his face, too, crusted around his nose and eyes, smearing across his cheeks. A stone dropped in my stomach. Had this green been marked, too? Was Dr. Begbie cutting him the same deal? I couldn't have been the only one to figure out how to dodge the sorting system, who to influence, when to lie. Maybe he and I were the same color beneath our skin, and maybe we would both be dead by tomorrow. "Keep up," the PSF snapped. He didn't try to hide his annoyance as I hobbled after him, but he didn't need to worry. You couldn't have paid me to stay in the infirmary, not while I was conscious, not even with the new threat hanging over my head. I knew what they used to do there. I knew what was under the layers of white paint. The earliest kids they had brought in, the first guinea pigs, had been subjected to a whole array of electroshock and brain chop-shop terrors. Stories were passed around camp with sick, almost holy reverence. The scientists were looking for ways to strip the kids' abilities, rehabilitate them. But they had mostly just stripped their will to live. The ones who made it out were given warden positions when the first small wave of kids was brought to camp. It was a strange bit of luck and timing that I had come in during the second wave. Each wave grew larger and larger as the camp expanded, until, 3 years ago, they'd run out of space completely. There were no new buses after that. I still wasn't moving fast enough for the soldier. He pushed me forward into the hall of mirrors. The exit sign cast its gory light over us. The PSF shoved me again, harder, and smiled when I fell. Anger flooded through me, cutting through the lingering pain in my limbs and any fear I had that he was taking me out somewhere in order to finish the job. Soon we were standing outside, breathing in the damp spring air. I took a lungful of misty rain and swallowed the bitterness down. I needed to think. Assess. If he was taking me outside to be shot and was on his own, I could easily overpower him. That wasn't the issue. But in fact, I had no way of slipping past the electric fence, and no idea where the hell I was. When they had brought me to Thurmond, the familiarity of the scenery had been more a comfort than a painful reminder. West Virginia and Virginia aren't all that different, even though Virginians would have you believe otherwise. Same trees, same sky, same awful weather. I was either drenched in rain or sticky with humidity. Anyway, it might not have been West Virginia at all, but a girl in my cabin swore up and down that she had seen a Welcome to West Virginia sign on her ride in, so that was the theory we were working with. The PSF had slowed considerably, matching my pathetic pace. He fumbled once or twice against the muddy grass, nearly tripping over himself in full view of the soldiers high above on the control tower. The moment the tower came into view, a whole new weight added itself to the ball and chain of terror I was dragging behind me. The building itself wasn't that imposing. It was only called the tower because it stuck up like a broken finger in a sea of one-story wooden shacks arranged in rings. The electric fence was the outer ring, protecting the world from us freaks. Cabins of greens made up the next two rings, blues the next two rings. Before they were taken away, the few reds and oranges lived in the next rings. They'd been closest to the tower. Better, the controllers thought, to keep an eye on them. But after a red had blown up his cabin, they moved the reds farther away, using the greens as a buffer in case any of the real threats tried to make a run for the fence. Number of escape attempts? 5. Number of successful escape attempts? 0. I don't know of one blue or green who had ever tried to make a run for it. When kids did stage desperate, pathetic breakouts, it had been in small groups of reds, oranges, and yellows. Once caught, they never came back. But that was in the early days, when we had had more interaction with the other colors, and before they shuffled us around. The empty red, orange, and yellow cabins became blue cabins, and newly arriving greens, the biggest group of all, filled the old blue ones. The camp grew so large that the controllers staggered our schedules, so we ate by color and gender, and even then it was still a tight squeeze fitting everyone at the tables. I hadn't seen a boy my own age up close in years. I didn't start breathing again until the tower was at our backs and it was clear, beyond a shadow of a doubt, where we were headed.
Thank you,
I thought, to no one in particular. The relief lodged in my throat like a stone. We reached cabin 27 a few minutes later. The PSF walked me to the door and pointed to the spigot just to the left of it. I nodded and used the cold water to wash the blood off my face. He waited silently, but not patiently. After a few seconds, I felt his hand grab the back of my shirt and yank me up. Using his other hand, he slid his access card through the lock on our door. Ashley, one of the older girls in my cabin, shoved the door open the rest of the way with her shoulder. She took my arm in one hand and nodded in the direction of the PSF. That seemed to be enough for him. Without another word, he took off down the path.
Jesus Christ, she hissed as she dragged me inside. They couldn't have kept you another night? Oh no, they have to send you back early? Is that blood?
I waved her hands away, but Ashley pushed past the others and brushed my long, dark hair over my shoulder. At first, I didn't understand why she was looking at me like that, with wide eyes, rimmed with a raw pink. She sucked her bottom lip in between her teeth.
I really thought you were...
We were still standing by the door, but I could feel the chill that had taken over the cabin. It settled over my skin like cold silk. Ashley had been around these parts for far too long to really crack, but I was still surprised to see her so frazzled and at a loss for what to say. She and a few other girls were honorary leaders of our sad, mismatched group, nominated mostly because they hit certain bodily milestones before the rest of us and could explain what was happening to us without laughing in our faces. I offered a weak smile and a shrug, suddenly without words again. But she didn't look convinced, and she didn't let go of my arm. The cabin was dark and damp. The usual smell of mold clung to every surface. But I would have taken that over the infirmary's clean, sterile stench any day.
Let me... Ashley took a deep breath. Let me know if you're not. Got it?
And what would you be able to do about it? I wanted to ask. Instead, I turned to the back left corner of our cramped cabin. Whispers and stares followed my zigzagging path around the rows of bunk beds. The pillows tucked tight against my chest felt like they were on fire.
She was gone,
I heard someone say. Vanessa, who slept on the bottom bunk to the right of mine, had snuck up to Sam's bed. When I came into view, they stopped mid-conversation to stare down at me, eyes wide, mouths wider. The sight of them together was still sickening to me, even after a year. How many days and nights had I spent perched up there with Sam, steadfastly ignoring Vanessa's attempts to drag us into some stupid, pointless conversation? Sam's best friend slot had been vacant for less than 2 hours when Vanessa had slithered in, and not a day went by that Vanessa didn't remind me of that.
What?
Sam leaned over the edge of her bed. She didn't look haughty or hostile the way she usually did. She looked concerned, curious.
What happened to you?
I shook my head, my chest tight with all the things I wanted to say. Vanessa let out a sharp laugh.
Nice, real nice. And you wonder why she doesn't want to be your friend anymore?
I don't, Sam mumbled.
Whatever.
Sometimes I wondered if there was a part of Sam that remembered not just me, but the person she used to be before I ruined her. Amazing how I had managed to erase every good part of Sam, or at least all the parts I loved. One touch, and she was gone. A few girls asked me what had happened between the two of us. Most, I think, assumed Sam was being cruel when she claimed that we had never, ever been friends and never would be. I tried to play it off with shrugs, but Sam was the only thing that had made Thurmond bearable. Without her, it was no life at all. No life at all. I fingered the packet of pills. Our cabin was brown on brown on brown. The only color was the white of our sheets, and most of those had aged to an ugly yellow. There were no shelves of books, no posters, no pictures. Just us. I crawled onto my low bunk, dropping face first into the worn sheets. I breathed in their familiar scent, bleach, sweat, and something distinctly earthy, and tried not to listen to the conversation above me. Part of me had been waiting, I think, desperate to see if I could fix what I had done to my friend. But it was done. It was over and she was gone, and the only one to blame was me. The best thing I could do for her was disappear. Even if Dr. Begbie was playing me and they really were going to get rid of me, they wouldn't connect us. They wouldn't question or punish Sam because they thought she had helped me hide, like they would if we had still been friends. There were over 3,000 of us at Thurmond, and I was the last orange, maybe in the entire world, or one of two, if the boy in the infirmary was like me. It had only been a matter of time before they found out the truth. I was dangerous, and I knew what they did to the dangerous ones. The camp routine ran itself through, as it always did, churning us through the mess hall for dinner, to the washrooms, and back to the cabin for the night. The light was dim and fading outside, clinging to the first fringes of night. "All right, kittens," Ashley's voice. 10 minutes to lights out. Whose turn is it?"
"Mine. Should I just pick up from where we left off?"
Rachel was on the other side of the room, but her squeaky voice carried well. I could practically hear Ashley's eyes rolling. "Yes, Rachel, isn't that what we always do?"
"Okay, so the princess, she was in her tower, and she was still really sad."
"Girl," Ashley cut in, "you're going to have to spice this up or I'm skipping your boring ass and going to the next person."
"Okay,"
Rachel squeaked. I rolled over onto my side, trying to get a glimpse of her through the rows of bunk beds.
"The princess was in terrible pain. Terrible, terrible pain."
"Oh, God," was Ashley's only comment. "Next." Macy picked up the loose story threads the best she could.
"While the princess was locked away in her tower, all she could think about was the prince."
I missed how the story ended, my eyelids too heavy to keep them open. If there is a single thing I'll miss about Thurmond, I thought as I edged toward sleep, it's this. The quiet moments, when we were allowed to talk about forbidden things. We had to find a way to amuse ourselves because we had no stories, no dreams, no future, other than the ones we created for ourselves. I swallowed the two pills one at a time, the taste of chicken broth still on my tongue. The cabin lights had been off for 3 hours, and Sam had been snoring for two. I unsealed the bag and dropped the little pills into my hand. The clear bag went back into my bra, and the first pill went into my mouth. It was warm from being so close to my skin for so long, which didn't make it any easier to swallow. I popped the next one in before I lost the nerve, and winced as it clawed its way down my throat. And then, I waited. 5. I didn't remember falling asleep, only waking. Of course I did. My body was shaking so hard that I rolled right out of bed and hit my face against the next bunk over. Vanessa must have jumped out of her skin with the sudden bang and movement of her bed, because I heard her say, "What the hell, Ruby? Is that you?" I couldn't get up. I felt her hands on my face and registered she was now screaming my name, not just whispering it. "Oh, my God," someone said. It sounded like Sam, but I couldn't open my eyes. "Emergency button." Ashley's weight settled over my legs. I knew it was her, even as my brain came in and out of consciousness, and a white-hot light was burning behind my eyelids. Someone shoved something in my mouth, rubber and hard. I could taste blood, but I wasn't sure if it had come from my tongue or my lips or... Two pairs of hands lifted me from the ground, dropping me on some other surface. I still couldn't open my eyes. My chest was on fire. I couldn't stop shaking, and my limbs felt like they were caving in on themselves. And then I smelled rosemary. I felt soft, cool hands pressing against my chest. Then, nothing at all. Life came back to me in the form of a hard slap across the face. "Ruby," someone said. Come on, I know you can hear me. You have to wake up. I cracked my eyes open, trying not to cringe as the light flooded in. A door opened and creaked shut somewhere nearby.
Is that her? A new voice asked. Are you going to sedate her?
No, not this one, the first voice returned. I knew that voice. It was as sweet as it had been before, only this time it had a sharper edge. Dr. Begbie's hands came up beneath my arms and propped me up. She's tough. She can handle it. Something smelled horrible, acidic and rotten all at once. My eyes flew open. Dr. Begbie was kneeling beside me, waving something beneath my nose. What? The other voice I had heard belonged to a young woman. She had dark brown hair and pale skin, but that was all that was remarkable about her. Not realizing I was watching her, she stripped her blue scrubs off and threw them at Dr. Begbie. I didn't know where we were. The room was small, filled with shelves of bottles and boxes, and I couldn't smell anything besides whatever it was Dr. Begbie had used to wake me. Put these on, Dr. Begbie said, pulling me to my feet whether my legs were ready or not. Come on, Ruby, we've got to hurry. My body felt heavy, cracking at all my joints, but I did as I was told and pulled the scrubs over my uniform. While I was dressing, the other woman put her hands behind her back and waited as Dr. Begbie wrapped them together with thick silver duct tape. That finished, the doctor moved to tying the other woman's feet together. You're meeting them in Harvey. Make sure you take Route 215.
I know,
Dr. Begbie said as she chewed off another piece of tape and placed it over the woman's mouth.
Good luck.
What are you doing? I asked. My throat was scratchy and the skin around my mouth seemed to crack as I spoke. The doctor pulled my hair back, twisting it up into a messy bun that she secured with a rubber band. The other woman watched as her ID tags were dropped over my neck, and Dr. Begbie put a surgical mask over my face. I'll explain everything once we're out, but we can't waste time. They'll be doing rounds in 20 minutes, she said. You can't say anything. Understand? Play along. I nodded and let her push me outside of the dark room and into the dimmed hallway of the infirmary. Once again, my legs seemed to be failing me, but the doctor took it all in stride. She looped one of my arms over her shoulder and supported most of my weight. We're moving, she muttered. Return the cameras to their normal feeds. I looked over, but she wasn't talking to me. She was whispering to her gold swan pin. Not a word, she reminded me as we turned down another long hallway. We were moving so fast that we rustled the white curtains of the examination stalls as we passed them. The PSFs were black blurs as they stepped out of our way. Sorry, Dr. Begbie called after us. I've got to get this one home. I kept my eyes on the straight lines of tile passing under my feet. My head was still spinning so badly that I didn't realize we were heading outside until I heard the beep of the doctor's card passing through the lock swipe and felt the first drops of cool rain hit my scalp. They kept the camp's enormous stadium lights on at all hours of the night. The lights stood like giants across the camp, but all they reminded me of were night football games, the smell of fresh-cut grass, and the back of my dad's red Spartan sweater as he yelled for his old high school's team to run some damn offense at the top of his lungs. It was a short walk and stumble from the back of the infirmary to the pebbled parking lot. I actually wasn't sure if I was hallucinating or not. My sight went in and out of focus, but it was impossible to miss the sound of crunching gravel and the voice that yelled, "Everything okay over there?" I felt, rather than saw, Dr. Begbie tense. I tried to keep moving, to use her shoulder to prop myself up, but my legs just weren't working anymore. When I opened my eyes again, I was sitting up, staring at the standard-issue boots of a PSF soldier. He knelt down in front of me. Dr. Begbie was saying something to him, her voice as calm as the first time I had spoken to her. So sick, I offered to drive her home. I put the mask on her to make sure she didn't give the bug to anyone else. The soldier's voice became clearer. I hate that we always get sick from these kids. Would you mind helping me walk her over to my Jeep? Dr. Begbie asked. If she's sick, it'll just take a minute, the doctor interrupted, and I promise that if you have so much as even the sniffles tomorrow, I'll nurse you back to health myself. That was the voice I recognized, so sweet that it sounded like little bells. The soldier chuckled, but I felt him lift me up all the same. I tried not to lean against him, to grit my teeth against the jarring motion, but I could barely keep my head from rolling back. "Front seat?" he asked. Dr. Begbie was about to respond when the PSF's radio crackled to life. "Control has you on camera. Do you need assistance?" He waited until Dr. Begbie had opened the front passenger side door, and he set me down on the seat before replying. "Everything clear. Dr.—" He took my tags in hand, lifting them off my chest. "Dr. Rogers has the virus that's been going around. Dr.—"
"Begbie," came the quick reply. She slid into the driver's seat and slammed the door shut behind her. I glanced over, watching as she fumbled to get the key in the ignition. It was the first time I noticed her hands shaking.
"Dr. Begbie is driving her home for the night. Dr. Rogers's car will be here overnight. Please inform the morning guards when they do their tally. Roger that. Tell them to head straight for the gate. I'll notify the watch patrol to wave them through."
The Jeep sputtered to life in a series of grinding protests. I looked out through the windshield to the electric fence and the dark, familiar forest behind it. Dr. Begbie reached over to fasten my seatbelt.
"Man, she's out of it."
The PSF was back, leaning against Dr. Begbie's window. "I did give her some pretty strong stuff," Dr. Begbie laughed. I felt my chest clench.
"So, about tomorrow?"
"Come by and say hello, okay?" Dr. Begbie said. "I have a break around 3. She didn't give him a chance to reply. The tires spun against the gravel and the windshield wiper squealed to life. Dr. Begbie rolled up her window with a friendly wave, using her other hand to steer the car back and pull out of the parking space. The little green numbers on the dashboard read 2:45 a.m. "Try to cover your face as much as possible," she muttered before flicking on the radio. I didn't recognize the song, but I recognized David Gilmour's voice and the ebb and flow of Pink Floyd's synthesizers. She turned the volume down, taking a deep breath as she turned out of the lot. Her fingers tapped out a nervous rhythm on the steering wheel. "Come on, come on," she whispered, glancing down at the clock again. There was a line of 2 cars in front of us. Each waved forward with agonizing slowness. I thought she was going to crawl out of her skin by the time the last car pulled forward into the night. Dr. Begbie hit the gas too hard, and the Jeep lurched forward. The seatbelt snapped into a locked position when she slammed on the brakes, knocking the air out of my chest. She rolled the window down, but I was too tired to be afraid. I pressed my hand over my eyes and sucked in a deep breath. The surgical mask brushed against my lips. "I'm taking Dr. Rogers home. Let me just get her passes."
"It's fine. I have you on the schedule for tomorrow at 3 p.m., is that correct?"
"Yes, thank you. Please indicate Dr. Rogers will not be in."
"Understood?"
I was too tired to try to control my brain's wandering fingers. When Dr. Begbie touched me again, brushing the hair out of my face, an image bloomed to life behind my eyes. A dark-haired man, smiling broadly, with his arms around Dr. Begbie, spinning her and spinning her and spinning her until I could hear her delighted laughter in my ears. Kate cracked our windows, and the air rushing by brought in the scent of rain and carried me quickly into sleep. Six. It was still dark out when I opened my eyes. The AC blew through the vents, batting at the little yellow cardboard tree hanging down from the rearview mirror. Its vanilla fragrance was sickeningly sweet and so overwhelming that it turned my empty stomach. Mick Jagger crooned next to my ear, singing about war and peace and shelter, those kinds of lies. I tried to turn my face away from wherever the song was escaping from, but I only managed to smack my nose against the window and strain my neck. I sat straight up and almost hanged myself on the gray seatbelt. We weren't in the Jeep anymore. The night came back like a deep breath,
complete and overwhelming all at once. The glow of the green dashboard lit the scrubs I wore, and that was enough to flood my mind with the reality of what had happened. Smears of trees and undergrowth lined a road that was completely dark, save for the small car's weak yellow headlights. For the first time in years, I could see the stars that Thurman's monstrous lights had faded into non-existence. They were so bright, so clear, that they couldn't have been real. I didn't know what was more shocking, the endless stretch of road or the sky. Tears pricked at the back of my eyes. "Don't forget to breathe, Ruby," came the voice beside me. I pulled the surgical mask down from over my mouth as I looked over. Dr. Begbie's blonde hair was around her face, sweeping against her shoulders. In the time it had taken us to get from Thurman to wherever we were, she had stripped off her scrubs and changed into a black T-shirt and jeans. The night stained the skin under her eyes like bruises. I hadn't noticed the sharp angles that made up her nose and chin. "You haven't been in a car for some time, huh?" she laughed. But she was right. I was more aware of the forward lurch of the car than I was of my own heartbeat. "Dr. Begbie? Call me Kate," she interrupted, a bit harsher than before. I don't know if I reacted to the abrupt change of tone or not, but she immediately followed with, "I'm sorry. It's been a very long night, and I could use a cup of coffee." According to the dashboard, it was 4:30 a.m. I had only had 2 hours of sleep, but I felt more alert than I had all day, all week, all my life. Kate waited until the Rolling Stones had finished out their song before turning down the radio. "All they play are oldies now." I thought it was a joke at first, or something Washington wanted, but apparently that's all that gets requested these days. She snuck a look at me out of the corner of her eye. I can't imagine why. "Doctor, Kate," I said. Even my voice was stronger. "Where are we? What's going on?" Before she could answer, there was a cough from the back seat. I twisted around despite the pain in my neck and chest. Curled up there in a protective little ball was another kid, about my age or maybe a year younger. That other kid. Max, Matthew, whatever, from the infirmary, and he was looking far better than I felt as he slept on. "We just left Harvey, West Virginia," Kate said. "That's where we met with some friends that helped me switch cars and remove Martin back there from the medical trunk we had to smuggle him out in."
"Wait.
Oh, don't worry," Kate said quickly. "We made sure it had air holes."
Like that was my biggest concern? "They just let you take it out to the car?" I asked, "without even checking it?"
She glanced at me again, and I was proud of the look of surprise there. "The doctors at Thurmond use those trunks to transport medical waste. The camp controllers started forcing the doctors to dump the waste themselves when the budget got cut. Sarah and I had duty for this week."
"Sarah," I interrupted. "Dr. Rogers?"
She hesitated a split second before nodding. "Why did you tie her up? Why did she... Why are you helping us?" She answered my question with one of her own. "Have you ever heard of the Children's League?"
"Bits and pieces," I said, and only in whispers. If the rumors were true, they were an anti-government group.
They were the ones the younger kids, the later arrivals to Thurmond, claimed were trying to take down the camp system. The ones that supposedly hid kids so they couldn't be taken. I had always assumed they were our generation's version of a fairy tale. Nothing that good could ever be true.
"We?" Kate said, letting that word sink in before continuing. "Are an organization dedicated to helping children affected by the government's new laws. John Albin. Have you heard of him? He was formerly an intelligence advisor to Gray."
"He started the Children's League?" She nodded. "After his daughter died and he realized what was going to happen to the kids who survived,
He left D.C. and tried to expose all of the testing that was happening at the camps. The New York Times, the Post, you name it. None of them would run the story, because by then things were bad enough that Gray had them under his thumb for national security reasons, and the smaller papers folded along with the economy. So, I was trying to wrap my mind around this, wondering if I had misheard her. So he created the Children's League to help us? Kate's face lit up in a smile. Yes, that's exactly right. Then why did you help only me? The question sprung up like a lone weed, ugly and deeply rooted. I rubbed a hand over my face, trying to clear the rumblings in my brain, but I couldn't tear it out. There was a strange feeling rising in my chest that followed, like something heavy was trying to work its way up from my center. It might have been a scream. What about the others? I didn't recognize my own voice. The others? You mean the other children? Kate's eyes were focused only on the road in front of us. They can wait. Their situation wasn't as pressing as yours was. When the time is right, I'm sure we'll go back for them. But in the meantime, don't worry. They'll live. I recoiled almost instantly at her tone more than her words. The way she said that, they'll live, was so dismissive. I half expected to see a hand come up into the air to wave me off. Don't worry. Don't worry at the way they've been mistreated. Don't worry about their punishments. Don't worry about the guns constantly trained on their backs. God, I wanted to throw up. I had left them behind. All of them. I had left Sam even after I promised we'd get out together. After everything she had done to protect me, I had just left her there. Oh, no, Ruby. I'm sorry, I didn't even realize how that would sound, she said, turning back and forth between me and the road. I just meant, I don't even know what I'm saying. I was there for weeks, and I still can't begin to imagine what it must have been like. I shouldn't act like I know what you went through. I left them, I told her, and it didn't matter that my voice was breaking or that my hands had come up to clutch my elbows to keep from grabbing her. Why did you only take me? Why couldn't you save the others? Why? I told you before, she said softly. It had to be you. They would have killed you otherwise. The others aren't in danger. They're always in danger, I said, and wondered if she had stepped a single foot beyond the infirmary. How could she not have seen? How could she not have heard it, felt it, breathed it in? The air at Thurmond was so coated in fear that you could taste it like vomit at the back of your throat. It had taken me less than a day in that place to see that hatred and terror came in circles, and that they fed off each other. The PSFs hated us, so they had to make us fear them. And we feared them, which only made us hate them even more. There was an unspoken understanding that we were at Thurmond because of each other. Without the PSFs, there would be no camp. But without the Psy Freaks, there would be no need for PSFs. So, whose fault was it? Everyone's? No one's? Ours? You should have just left me. You should have taken someone else, someone who was better. They'll be punished because of this, I know it. They'll hurt them, and it's my fault for going, for leaving them behind. I knew I wasn't making sense, but I couldn't seem to connect my thoughts to my tongue. That feeling, the heart-swallowing guilt, the sadness that took hold and never let itself be shaken free. How did you tell someone that? How did you put that into words? Kate's lips parted, but no sound came out for several moments. She took a firm hold of the wheel and guided the car over to the side of the road. Her foot came off the gas, and she allowed the car to roll to a hesitant stop. When the wheels finally ceased spinning, I reached for the door handle, a spike of total and complete grief cutting through me. "What are you doing?" Kate asked. She had pulled over because she wanted me to get out, hadn't she? I would have done the same thing if our situations had been flipped. I understood. I leaned back away from her arm as she reached over, but instead of pushing the door open, she slammed it shut and let her fingers linger over my shoulder. I cringed, pressing back against the seat as hard as I could.